Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives. The author is Ellen Brown, and it is a book that everyone should read. In the solution area, we have tapped into a number of sources and resources, in particular the Thrive Movement website, thrivemovement.com. We specifically investigated into the top 10 actions, what you can do in terms of solutions. Those, as a brief review, are 1. Get informed, speak up, and connect with others. 2. Bank locally. 3. Buy and invest responsibly. 4. Join the movement to audit and end the Federal Reserve. 5. Keep the internet fair and open. 6. Support independent media. 7. Support organic non-GMO farming. 8. Require election and campaign finance reform. 9. Advocate for renewable and free energy. And 10. Take part in critical mass action. In the last show, we were talking about economic solutions strategies. There were 3 stages. First stage, reform current systems. The second stage, limit government control. And the third stage is voluntary cooperation. We ended up the show before we got to any discussion of the voluntary cooperation. I'd like to do a little bit of that now. In brief, we want to set up systems for voluntary cooperation. In this stage, coercive government ideally is dissolved and private voluntary enterprises, including justice, insurance, and security, compete for the respect of potential customers. People set up systems for voluntary cooperation. No force, no coercion, unless someone is violating someone else. Of course, many questions arise when we transition from a parental type state, telling us what to do and what not to do, what to study, who we can marry, what gets put in our water, who has to go to war for the benefit of corporations, etc. How would we deal with criminals, schooling, healthcare? How would the economy function? These are legitimate and important points to address as we make the transition to full and complete freedom for everyone. Fortunately, many people have already thought a lot about this and come up with empowering stage 3 systems and solutions. The challenge lies in the transition. How do we get there? For the economics sector, there would need to be a truly free market and some form of private judicial and security systems. And this is just possibilities. Here are some possibilities. Establish a truly free market. We have never experienced a truly free market without government intervention. There would be tremendous innovation, diversity, and growth to create thriving economic systems. The best banking models, trade networks, and currency systems would rise to the top. Because stage three is based on non-violation, there would also be far more sustainable products and services available. And then set up systems for protection. In stage three, state courts would no longer be necessary. To take their place, researcher and host of Freedom Domain Radio, Stefan Molyneux, suggests using dispute resolution organizations, or DROs. Each person would have a DRO similar to an insurance company to ensure their daily activities. DROs would provide insurance for contracts and charge a fee based on the risk of the contract. If someone breaks the contract, the DRO pays for it. DROs incentivize good behavior because that keeps people's costs down. The DROs are also incentivized to encourage good behavior because then they make more money from fees and have to pay less for their clients' bad behavior. This is explored in a lot of places on the Thrive Movement website, and these are just ideas of how a stateless society could deal with crime in a nonviolent way. In sum, what I have been doing is just offering some ideas on how to deal with the basis of the economic system in a holistic, productive way for people at the root, not just people at the top of the economic pyramid. We want to get beyond the usual discussion and explore revolutionary possibilities that actually get to the root of the problems. As I've mentioned, research and information directly implicates the global central banking system, of which the Federal Reserve is a key part in the United States, in creating the devastation and suffering that so many people are experiencing around the world. Powerful elite bankers have literally hijacked governments, wielding more influence than any other sector. We have seen and experienced it in the most recent economic collapse. Wall Street bankers who created the problem were bailed out with taxpayer money, ultimately gaining even more power and money, clearly making banks who are already too big to fail even bigger is not an effective strategy or solution. Rather, it sets everyone up for more vulnerability in the future and gives banks even more control over our government and over us. So to summarize, reforming current systems is essential, limiting government control is essential, and voluntary cooperation as the third stage is essential. And I'd like to branch out to another issue in the life and debt area, and that's related to health. Today I'm going to have an audio interview from internationally renowned natural health physician and Mercola.com founder, Dr. Joseph Mercola. He's interviewing Ellen Brown, who is the civil litigation attorney and author of The Web of Debt, which we have gone very deeply into. And he's going to talk to her about the politics of health as well as forbidden medicine. And this will be through two shows. And it, of course, relates to the big central banking issues that confront us. You can actually watch this on the YouTube. Dr. Mercola interviews Ellen Brown about politics of health. I will start in a moment after a break. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So now we'll hear Dr. Mercola interviewing Ellen Brown about politics of health.
Welcome, everyone. This is Dr. Mercola, and today we are delighted to be joined by Ellen Brown, who is a civil litigation attorney who has written 11 books on health and the politics of health, including The Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System, which focuses on the banking system and the money system itself, as well as Forbidden Medicine, which traces the suppression of natural health treatments by the same corrupting influences that run our money system. So I am just very excited to have the opportunity to dialogue with you about these really important topics. So thank you for joining us today, Ellen.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be on your program. I used your website all the time when I was doing medical research. That was the first place I went.
It's good to know we provided some value and service there for you. So I'm wondering if you could provide to our listeners and viewers a framework on how you first became interested in money and the banking system and how it relates to the suppression of many of these natural health treatments that we talk about on the website.
Well, my first degree was in English from Berkeley, and I wanted to be a writer, but I was young, you know, I was in my 20s, and I did a lot of research, and the three things that interested me were, one was banking and economics, one was health, and one was spirituality, or where we came from, or what we were doing here. But I was really too young to support myself as a writer, so I finally went back to law school. And the first thing I ever got published was a law review article called Restrictions on Unorthodox Medical Treatment in California, a Legal and Economic Analysis, in 1977. And then I practiced law for 10 years, and then my ex-husband burned out on LA law, and we went in the Foreign Service, and that gave me a chance to write. So I did write these 10 books. And in the course of that, I was asked to join the legal team of Jimmy Keller, who was an alternative cancer therapist in Tijuana, wound up in jail. And
He wound up in jail.
I mean, I'd gone on a tour of the cancer clinics, the Cancer Control Society tour, and my co-author, Lynn, who's a pharmacist, and she had burned out on drugs and had switched over to alternative. She got three more degrees in alternative remedies, and one of her patients was a Jimmy Keller patient, and that woman contacted me and said he was in jail. And I mean, this is after we'd done the tour and we had been quite impressed with his clinic. And she said he was in jail and he needed somebody to write an article. And they had a journal that would publish it. They just needed a writer. So I wrote the article, and then he contacted me and wanted me to join his legal team. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got involved in the whole thing. And in the course of that, of course, I interviewed all his patients, and I interviewed him a lot. I mean, he was in jail altogether for 4.5 years for the alleged fraud of representing that he had a high rate of cure for cancer, which, of course, I was quite convinced that he did after doing all this research. And one of he always showed the movie World Without Cancer to his patients, which is by Ed Griffin. And so I read the book, World Without Cancer, and it linked the cancer industry, the cancer cartel, basically, with the banking cartel. And it showed they had the same roots. It went back to the Rockefeller,
wow,
Morgan cartel of the turn of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. They said Rockefeller, Morgan, and Carnegie supported drugs and funded the medical schools and basically got the homeopathic schools shut down, which were in the 19th century, the homeopathic schools were the leading health treatments. So that was all very interesting. And I realized in the course of that if you wanted to get to the crux of the problem, you had to deal with banking, because that was actually where they got their power. They got their power from the power to create money. That the subtitle of my book that you just read was The Shocking Truth About Our Money System. The shocking truth is that virtually all of our money is created by banks when they make loans. It's not created by the government, as most people think. And of course, banks create the principal, but they don't create the interest. So they're always taking back more than they put out, which is a sort of parasitic growth on the economy. And that is where they get their money. Their money is how they manage to corner politics and buy up the media and basically monopolize the field.
So that is fascinating. So you first heard about the connection between the banking system and health with Edward Griffith's books or material?
Well, that actually reignited my interest because in my 20s I had researched that, the whole Federal Reserve issue. But at that time, you know, it was before the internet, and I would go to the library and the books wouldn't be there, or you'd formulate a question in your mind, but you just couldn't find the answers. So I decided it was just beyond me. I couldn't write on that subject. But then, and we were in the foreign, I came back from to the U.S. in 2000, and the whole internet was such a phenomenal development. You could formulate any question in your mind, and there was the answer. You could wonder how much money we had spent for this, or any sorts of charts. You could find anything you wanted. It was like your brain suddenly got much larger. So then I was confident to write on the subject. But yeah, and Ed Griffin's book, both books, The Creature from Jekyll Island as well, were revelatory. I mean, it was just like a...
Would you recommend this as a primer or a foundational book to material to read even at this point, or are there some better reviews that address this topic?
Creature from Jekyll Island is excellent, and also World Without Cancer, yes. And World Without Cancer, if you're particularly interested in the link between drugs and banking.
Interesting. So I'm still really curious about this because it's intuitively it makes sense. And I only recently, within this year, have come to the appreciation and understanding of exactly what you're speaking about. That, you know, we normally on our site, as you know, since you've been on it for a while, focus on the damage and the dangers that are done by the drug companies. And they're big, powerful, multi-billion-dollar, multinational corporations. But it's becoming more clear to me that the banking system is behind the drug companies.
Exactly.
And it started to come. And then I've encountered your material and I said, wow, it'd just be wonderful to have you dialogue on that. So I'm wondering if, you know, because it's obvious to you and those who are familiar with the Griffin's work, but it's not so obvious to most people viewing this. So I'm wondering if you could expand on that topic, because it's really such an essential and important connection to understanding what's the reality of what's going on in our world and how it works.
Well, the drug connection in the 19th century, John D. Rockefeller's father was actually literally a snake oil salesman. He was a patent remedy seller, and the drugs, of course, are oil based. And John D. Rockefeller was an oil magnate, and he also had a bank, and so did J.P. Morgan, and so the drug industry, the patent remedy industry, was in competition with the natural, the herbal remedies and the homeopathic remedies. And the way they prevailed in the whole system was that, first of all, they funded the American Medical Association, the AMA Journal, which got their funding from advertising. And if your drug was advertised in the AMA Journal, then you got the AMA seal of endorsement. And so those drugs, you know, it was just sort of it was a cartel. But the interesting thing is the banking part. The thing that most people don't realize is that banks don't just take in people's money and then lend it out again. What they do is they literally, every time they make a loan, they create that money on their books. They do have to, they need the deposits in order to clear the checks, but they're basically double counting the money. They take in your deposit. You never go to the bank and the bank says, you never put your money in the bank and then you go to withdraw it and they say, sorry, we just lent your money out to your neighbor for 30 years. You'll have to come back later. They always give you your money. That's because your deposit's still there at the same time that they've lent it out. So if you need the money, then they borrow it from somewhere else. Well, where do they borrow it from? Basically, from the very bank that the check just went into from the loan that they just made. So it's like a big check-kiting scheme where you create the money, it goes into another bank, and then you borrow a bank back. But the banks can borrow it back at 0.25% at the moment, which is the Fed funds rate. And of course, they lend it out at 5%, or credit cards maybe 18%, or student loans, or, you know, outrageous interest rates. So they get a huge spread on money that didn't actually exist until they created this loan. So that's all. I mean, I published that book. I started writing Web of Debt in 2001 or 2002, and published it in 2007, the first time. It's in its fifth edition, and I'm still researching. I mean, there is no end to it. It's like this huge onion, and every time you peel off one layer, there's another layer under there, and it's so interesting and so complicated. I mean, they've made it purposely complicated and purposely hidden. I mean, now you get into the whole derivatives scheme, which is almost impossible to understand, and that's up to, well, some people say it's up to $1.5 quadrillion.
I'll come back to this in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond.
Well, some people say it's up to $1.5 quadrillion. I mean, it's way into the imaginary numbers.
Well, I thought it was 500 trillion, so it's just double that.
Well, the Bank for International Settlements reports is the 500 trillion, I think it's 600 trillion. But if you count all the sales, I don't know, I did read the $1.5 quadrillion figure.
Wow. So I'm still a bit curious, though, on this, the bank's ability to create money out of thin air. My understanding is that was that the Federal Reserve had the authority to do that. Can you expand on the difference between the Federal Reserve and the banks? In many cases the same? I mean, when Chase does it, is it different than when the Federal Reserve does it?
The banks all do it, and the Federal Reserve is called the lender of last resort, so they are allowed to do it without actually backing the money from anywhere. In other words, they just create it. So there are basically two banking systems. This is also very complicated, but there's what's called base money, and that's created by the Federal Reserve, and those are the reserves. You know, at one time the reserves were gold, mm-hmm. and you actually literally had to keep a certain amount of gold for when your depositors could cash in their dollars for gold. But in 1933, everybody stopped trusting the banks because they knew they didn't have enough gold, so there were runs on the banks. And at that time, the dollar was 40% backed by gold. So every time somebody would bring $2 and cash it in for gold, the bank had to call in $3 worth of loans. So the whole money supply was just closing in on itself and collapsing. And that's why Roosevelt finally took the dollar off the gold standard. And then to back the dollar, we used these reserves, which were Federal Reserve money created by the Federal Reserve. But it's sort of a separate system where they create these reserves. We don't get to borrow the Fed's reserves. That's like the banker's money. The banker's bank is the Federal Reserve.
Okay.
And they have to have, it's the reserves that they use to clear the checks.
Mm.
But the banks themselves do virtually all of the money creation, and the Federal Reserve just responds. If there aren't enough reserves, right now the reserve requirement is supposed to be 10%, so you're supposed to have a 10% pile of reserves either at the Federal Reserve or in cash. Cash counts as reserves, cash in your vault. So if there aren't enough, if the banks have created so much money that there's not enough reserves to clear checks, then the Federal Reserve will automatically create more reserves, and they do it because they have a target interest rate. It's pretty complicated to explain. It's easier to write about, but anyway.
All right, so, and you explain this in your book, so if anyone is interested in this fascinating subject, they could learn more about it in the books, which certainly are available.
And the Federal Reserve was a backstop for, in the 19th century, There would be periodic runs on the banks when people would realize that the banks didn't have the gold. And so the Federal Reserve was set up in 1913 to backstop all that so they could provide the reserves. And that didn't work. 20 years later, we still had the biggest bank run in history. So then they set up the system where they could just create the reserves. They didn't have to get gold from somewhere. They could just create it on their books.
So let's get back a little bit to your initial research that you wrote with respect to the health, which was these cancer treatments that were in California, I believe you stated, right? The cancer treatment.
Well, I graduated from UCLA Law School, and I wrote an article on the California regulations on doctors and other medical professions, and how it basically acts as a sort of closed shop. It keeps all competitors out. So I was writing about the economics of it and how it was actually not a good idea, all this licensing. What would be better, what I liked at the time, was Milton Friedman's idea, where you could just put a little sign on your wall and say, buyer beware, I do not have a medical license. And then if you, the client, wanted to go there, that was up to you, but at least you knew what you were getting into. But no, it's absolutely illegal to treat cancer. It's illegal to use the word cure on cancer if you're not an MD.
Well, there's a lot there. It's not just cancer though. It's all diseases,
right.
And it's sort of in some ways it's an unfair monopoly that's occurred. And and I suspect you can maybe comment on this, but even though I'm a licensed physician, I think it's an unfair restriction to the whole healing profession, because what it essentially does is it makes it illegal to not only treat cancer but any other disease. And there's very serious legal penalties if you are caught and found to practice medicine without a license. So, but I'm far more in favor of the Milton Friedman proposal, which would maybe have the states, rather than giving you a license, giving you a certification, state qualified certification, says, yes, you pass this test and you're certified and anyone go to see you, but it's not illegal for someone to practice medicine without certification. So, and I really think that's the way it ideally should be, but of course it's not. And it provides individuals who've completed that licensing process an unfair advantage. And really, through a very clever, sophisticated process, as I suspect you discuss in your books, they really, here's the connection. It's just that the banking system and then the drug companies on top of it, the most clever and sophisticated marketing tools that they are able to essentially influence and manipulate the leaders in the profession, so they essentially control the whole profession, and any competition is illegal. I mean, it's a very incredible, clever system that is guaranteed to benefit them in extraordinarily.
Yeah, and I think even worse than that is they controlled information, and so people don't even know that there are alternative remedies. Or if they do hear about them, they think it's quackery and that it's been disproven, because that's what the conventional media says. You really have to dig to find out what's out there and how well they work. And also you have to dig to find out how drugs don't work and how they've been hyped in a way that's not accurate.
And what has your investigation shown? Have you uncovered any really comprehensive strategies that you've learned that they're able to achieve this and really selectively screen out the useful information and any damaging information that might interfere with their profits?
Well, I remember one, I'm not sure, was it Sandra Day or was she there was one, she was an MD who got cancer herself. And she, her original thought was, no, there can't be any alternative remedies out there that work, because I would have heard about it. I'm a doctor. I read all the literature. I know what's out there. I know what's accepted and endorsed, and it's just not there. But then she did do some research, and she discovered some alternatives. She did some digging. I think it would, and besides your website, one thing that I think maybe before your website came online, I got heavily into the Townsend Letter for Doctors. Mm-hmm. That was a great source
I was
of information.
I wrote for them first. That's kind of what launched my website, because I had a column in that, a monthly column, and promoted my newsletter, so that's how it got started.
Yeah, I wrote several articles for them. That was one of the first places I published too. But so you could find good research, not just fringe type books, but you could actually find good research.
And we will continue next week with Dr. Mercola interviewing Ellen Brown about politics of health, which of course relates to the foundation of the banking industry. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.